Nuclear intersectionalism.
Say what?
That's the academic term for the place where nuclear fits into a continuum of issues dealing with injustices based on race, religion, gender, minority oppression, and poverty. It can be a challenge to see nuclear as relating to anything beyond, well, energy technologies. But there's a growing awareness that human values, humane values, are all part of the same discussion. And we gain power, encouragement, and strength by bonding with others who are fighting on their own home fronts. In that way, we come to understand each other, how we truly connect, and how nuclear connects with us all. So when a veteran nuclear campaigner and community organizer, someone who has been involved in coalition building with other activist communities for decades, tells you,
"So in addition to building power, when we are together in front of our elected representatives, we kind of show with who we are, the organizations we come from, and what we're paying attention to, how much these issues are interconnected. And largely, it's about values and priorities and prioritizing people over polluters, people over lobbyists, people over weapons manufacturers. And if we can do enough of this, I know we can make a change. We've seen it. Enough people speak out. Member of Congress, if they want to keep their position, they have to act."
Well, when Denise Duffield, Associate Director for Physicians for Social Responsibility Los Angeles, and so much more, explains it that clearly and concisely, you know you're dealing with another level of nuclear truth, and that by working together across our various issues and platforms with other activists with whom we have shared concerns, we just might be able to shut them down and take control over that dirty, deadly, awful, dangerous seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, a glimpse of last weekend's Conference on Global Legacies of Anti-Nuclear Activism, which was held at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Activists from around the world presented papers and network to build our strength, and I had the chance to interview the participants of the Environmental Injustice and Nuclear Technologies in California panel discussion. You'll hear from Denise Duffield of Physicians for Social Responsibility, Linda Seeley of San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace, Kathy Iwane, who lived in Japan through the Fukushima nuclear disaster and went on to fight for the closure and cleanup of San Onofre, Melissa Bumstead of Parents Against the Santa Susana Field Lab, and conference organizer Amanda Nichols of UCSB. We'll also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than any government official should be allowed to sleep through. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, April 16, 2024, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Here in the U.S., a reminder that the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act is set to expire this July. RECA, as it is known, has served as a crucial mechanism for providing one-time restitution to the veterans and communities that bore the brunt of contamination from the United States uranium industry and nuclear weapons program. There are only 22 days that Congress will be in session and the House will be available to vote on RECA. So your support is requested by a wide range of indigenous and other groups to contact your congressperson and tell them to support RECA. It has already passed the Senate with bipartisan support and needs to be extended. We will have links up on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 669, which will show you how to find out who your representative is, how to contact them, and basic information on what to say. Please, if you've not done this yet, go for it. We need your support. Kevin Camps, the nuclear waste watchdog for Beyond Nuclear, goes into the Palisades situation in great detail in Nuclear Hot Seat number 667 from last week, April 9th. And we will also link to a recent press release that he just put out that contains further information. He goes into a full list of exactly why this is a really bad idea and a waste of taxpayer money. In Missouri, several people were handcuffed at the National Nuclear Security Administration's plant in South Kansas City on Monday, April 15. About 50 people gathered outside the entrance to the plant to protest nuclear weapons and the decision to expand the site. Anne Suellentrope, a local activist who sits on the National Board of Physicians for Social Responsibility, said, "We're going the wrong way. We're manufacturing our doom." The plant's website states that it is focused on, quote, developing, producing, procuring, and delivering over 80% of all non-nuclear components in support of the U.S. nuclear deterrent. Meanwhile, the Missouri House of Representatives is poised to pass a bill that would offer a sales tax exemption on all materials needed to expand the National Nuclear Security Administration's plant. So Missouri can come up with a tax break for nukes, but not support for the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act for people who have been harmed by the manufacture of nukes and the material that goes into them. Priorities, people. And now,
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Num Nuts of the Week.
The U.S. government wants to transform old nuclear bomb testing grounds into clean energy powerhouses. And thus, the Department of Energy and the National Nuclear Security Administration are offering up land where nuclear weapons were tested for decades. And son of a gun, solar developers are lining up for a chance to build renewable energy projects on these sites. This initiative, called Clean Up to Clean Energy, they're so good at slogans, aims to make productive use of quote-unquote contaminated lands that have long sat idle, and for good reason. They're contaminated. Yet, six solar companies have already submitted proposals in response to the government's initial request for information in December. Now, the National Nuclear Security Agency is taking the next step, considering leasing acreage on the Nevada National Security Site, the former nuclear testing location just outside of Las Vegas. Of course, there's no information provided about radiation levels in the dust and dirt, how deep those radiation levels go that will be stirred up during the construction process, what water, a very rare commodity in that area, is going to be required, and what about Native American treaty rights to that land. Just like nuclear interests everywhere, if you've got contaminated land, turn it into a nature preserve or a site for solar energy. It looks good on the surface, but man, what's going on beneath that? And that's why Department of Energy and National Nuclear Security Administration, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Num Nuts of the Week.
Over to Japan, where Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO, will be loading fuel at the long-idled Kashiwazaki Kariwa nuclear plant for the first time since the Fukushima disaster in 2011. Niigata is only 127 kilometers, 79 miles, away from Fukushima, site of a 9.0 earthquake and a triple meltdown at the nuclear power plant in 2011. Reloading nuclear power plants in the world's most earthquake-prone country? Not necessarily a good idea. And speaking of not good ideas, a new partnership is bringing together the U.S. Department of Energy and Japan's Ministry of Education, Culture, Sports, Science, and Technology to work to accelerate the demonstration and commercialization of fusion energy. The partnership is expected to further develop complementarity between U.S. and Japanese resources and facilities in fusion, including universities, national laboratories, and private companies in respective countries. They're calling it clean, they're calling it green, they're calling it anything but late for supper. And of course, they're saying that progress will be showing up in 10 years because fusion is always 10 years away. That's where it's been for the last 50 years, 10 years away. Don't hold your breath. In Ukraine, the last of the still operating nuclear reactors at the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant is being transferred to cold shutdown to minimize risks to nuclear safety and security. The six-reactor facility, which has been under Russian military control since early March of 2022, stopped generating electricity in September 2022, but has kept one of its units in hot shutdown to provide heating for the plant and the nearby town of Energodar. Rafael Grossi, head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, said, "Switching to cold shutdown is a positive step for nuclear safety and security, although one that is currently overshadowed by the great military dangers facing the plant." In the UK, Sir Keir Starmer, a member of Parliament, leader of the opposition, and leader of the Labour Party, has reaffirmed his commitment to nuclear weapons and labeled it unshakable and absolute. He has announced his plans to raise defense spending to 2.5% of the GDP as soon as resources allow. He has also stated that he would press the nuclear button. In opposition, Defense Secretary Grant Shapps said Labour could not, quote, be trusted with our nation's defenses, and accused Sir Keir of, quote, saying whatever he needs to get your vote. And in Scotland, Isabel Lindsay, co-vice chair of Scottish Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, has stated that an independent Scotland must take a stand against nuclear weapons and, once independent, have all nuclear weapons and delivery systems removed. Scotland currently holds around 240 nuclear bombs based only 30 miles from their densest population areas. Scotland is part of the UK, but they have no say over the deployment of these weapons and won't until they gain independence. We'll have this week's featured interviews in just a moment, but first, what bothers you the most about nuclear? Bombs? Forever quantities of highly radioactive waste? Cancer threats from radiation exposure? Contamination of land that many of us live near, if not on? You can do nothing about nuclear threats to health and safety without knowing the truth about them. And communicating that truth is the self-selected mandate for Nuclear Hot Seat. We provide you with verified information that you need to understand what's happening in the nuclear industry, information that is not influenced by their millions of dollars spent every week in a never-ending propaganda media machine. We cover not only what you face, but what you, what we, what any of us can do about it. Every week we bring you the kind of nuclear information that mainstream media just doesn't seem to have the heart, or time, or money to put on the air, in print, or online. And on occasion, such as this past week, we are able to travel to events to go up close and personal, on site, with the work of committed activists. It's all part of Nuclear Hot Seat's mission statement, to do whatever we can to keep those who work against nuclear informed and in good heart. So here's where you get to help. Nuclear Hot Seat runs exclusively on donations and cannot survive without your support. So if you're grateful for the information you get from the show, now is the time to help us out. Be it a one-time donation or monthly recurring, any amount, you'll be supporting the services required to keep this program running. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means your donation is tax deductible. Go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the red donate button or send directly via Zelle to info@nuclearhotseat.com. No amount is too small, no amount is too large, so don't wait. Go to nuclearhotseat.com to donate now. And whatever you can do to help, I'm deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now, here are this week's featured interviews. Last weekend, University of California at Santa Barbara hosted a three-day Global Legacies Conference in partnership with NYU Abu Dhabi. Speakers from around the world came together to talk on the interconnectedness of a range of issues that overlap with the detrimental effects of nuclear, including the wrong-headed talking points that it's somehow a fix for climate change. It's not. And how nuclear is the wrong way to pursue a clean energy future. The full three-day program featured inquiries into the intersection of religion, gender, sexuality, and nuclear. I attended as ambassador to the United States for the International Uranium Film Festival, which gave me the honor of introducing Heidi Huttner's award-winning film, Radioactive, The Women of Three Mile Island. After the screening, I conducted a Q&A with Heidi that was open to the audience, and there was very avid participation. Unfortunately, I was only able to attend for that one day, but it allowed me to sit in on the roundtable discussion, Environmental Injustice and Nuclear Technologies in California. The presentation was not recorded, but I was able to speak with its participants afterwards and capture some of their more significant talking points. First, Denise Duffield. Among her many positions and accomplishments, she is Associate Director of Physicians for Social Responsibility Los Angeles, a board member of the Alliance for Nuclear Accountability, and is on the management team of Back from the Bomb. Here, she talks about crucial strategies for building our movement as we help build others. This and all other interviews were recorded on April 12 and 13, 2024.
You were just talking about how to build coalitions and some of the groups you've been working with. Spell that out for the listeners.
Well, the reason why we build coalitions is because we need more power, particularly in this movement. There's two kinds of power. There's money power and there's people power. We don't have the money power, so we need to build the people power. And that's what organizing is about. And I think all true social change happens that way from the bottom up. And so when we reach out, we try to find common cause with groups. We have had great success working with the faith community, which understands inherently that nuclear weapons are unjust and immoral, with the environmental community, with racial justice community, with health. Obviously, I'm from health and science, and veterans, atomic veterans. And when more and more groups come in and start to weigh in on this together, we build power. And so I think a lot of what we're doing on Back from the Brink is doing that in localities, because, again, it's a lot easier to break out of our silos locally because we all live in the same place. So that is happening now with the Back from the Brink campaign. We have, I think, 17 hubs that are meant to do just that, leveraging relationships. Can you talk to your mayor? Can you talk to your, you know, people talking to their congregations, their professional organizations, and leveraging the relationships that we have so that when we meet with our representatives, we are showing them that the people who live in your district, who work here, who go to school here, who go to church here, demand that you take action. And we want to demonstrate to you how much support there is. And that's when we can start showing the resolutions. That's when we can start showing the state and the mayors who weighed in on this issue. And that's the whole idea. It's about building power. And again, because we are so severely under-resourced in this movement, it's one of the best ways we have to leverage what we have, which is relationships, building them, growing them, demonstrating support, and demanding change.
You gave an example during the talk that was very powerful and very specific.
Yeah. On the national level, Back from the Brink became a mobilizing partner for the Poor People's Moral March in Washington in 2022. A lot of the Poor People's campaign work is now at the state level, so a lot of the Back from the Brink hubs are now starting to reach out, make conversations, and join the Poor People's campaign, either the movements, whatever they're working on locally. So in Los Angeles, Maylene Hughes, who's the Los Angeles-based organizer that's now on with PSRLA, we met with a representative from the Poor People's Campaign, Nancy Berlin, just to talk about, get to know each other, see what you're doing, see what we're doing. It happened to be right before the April 4th, which was the time that the campaign does the reading of MLK's Beyond Vietnam speech. So it was sort of like well-timed. One of their tenets is interlocking injustices are poverty, racism, ecological devastation, militarism, and false Christian nationalism. And within the militarism platform is anti-nuclear platform. So we were talking about what we were doing and how we could work together. And we started talking about HR 77, which is a House bill right now that is essentially a back from the brink resolution. And, you know, would there be times that we could, if we see who do you know who's in this person's district or that person's district? And I mentioned that we really wanted to talk to Linda Sanchez, but we were having trouble finding community members in her district. And Nancy's like, well, we have a relationship with that office, and we have a relationship, she mentioned a couple other Southern Californians, who we've been meeting with on the child tax credit. And so it was sort of like, why don't we do these meetings together? Why wouldn't we talk about something that is so central to people's lives, to communities, to well-being, in this horrible enterprise now, the largest nuclear weapons budget ever, weapons we cannot and must not use, that do not keep us safe, that poison the environment, that are unjust in so many ways. If we're talking about that, if we're joining with other groups that are working on anti-poverty measures of any kind, anything that is under-resourced severely that people need, then we're making a powerful argument just by our bodies being there, talking about this together. So in addition to building power, when we are together in front of our elected representatives, we kind of show with who we are, the organizations we come from, and what we're paying attention to, how much these issues are interconnected. And largely, it's about values and priorities and prioritizing people over polluters, people over lobbyists, people over weapons manufacturers. If we can do enough of this, I know we can make a change. We've seen it. Enough people speak out. Member of Congress, if they want to keep their position, they have to act. You know, look what happened with Josh Hawley. You know, it's like sometimes we move hearts in the least expected places as well.
If people want to explore further about this coalition building, I would like to get in touch with you. How can they do so?
PreventNuclearWar.org. So you can find out. There might be a hub near you. You can join or you can start one. We have, and the other thing that I love about this campaign is that we offer anybody a way to have meaningful impact. I like to talk about one gentleman who I helped his daughter work on her Girl Scout project on nuclear weapons. He comes in from SGI. This one man, you know, got his representative to co-sponsor, has three resolutions he's working on. Anybody can make a difference in this campaign, and we'll help. PreventNuclearWar.org.
That was Denise Duffield of Physicians for Social Responsibility Los Angeles, and so much more. Next, I caught up with Melissa Bumstead. She is the founder and co-director of Parents Against the Santa Susana Field Lab, referred to colloquially as SSFL. It is one of California's most toxic places and the site of one of America's worst nuclear meltdowns. Having dealt with cancer in multiple family members, including her daughter when she was only 4 years old, Melissa is very attuned to information about cancer and its connection to exposure to radioactivity. Here is what she had to say about a recent discovery.
I'm talking with Melissa Bumstead of Parents Against Santa Susana Field Laboratory. Melissa, in the discussion that was just going on, you shared some remarkable information about a breast cancer study in California. What were you talking about in there?
The California Breast Cancer Mapping Project was done in November 2012 by the Breast Cancer Research Program and the Public Health Institute. It had nothing to do with the site where I live, near the Santa Susana Field Lab, which is a radioactively contaminated site near Los Angeles. But when I went through it, I found that there are few areas in California that have a 10 to 20% higher invasive cancer rate compared to the rest of California. And not surprisingly, my community is one of those communities. We live near radioactivity, and the breast cancer rates we knew were higher just from people speaking about it, and we knew from a separate federally funded epidemiological study that the cancer rates of different types of cancers were higher. So it wasn't a huge surprise. The thing that shocked me, though, is that the other three communities that are pointed out in this study as having a higher than the rest of California breast cancer are also radioactive sites. And this project did not intend to do any sort of causation or correlation of what might be causing these cancers. But the other cancers sites were near San Onofre, near Diablo Nuclear Plant, and near Hunter's Point, which is also radioactive. I am not an epidemiologist, and I can't speak to this study, as I'm not one of the scientists who worked on it, but you know, even just looking at it with a layperson's eyes and knowing what I know about those sites being radioactive and knowing that radioactivity causes breast cancer in women, it makes sense. And I think it probably needs a lot more research to show where else this might be happening in across America.
Do you know of any studies that are going on that are studying this further?
I do not right now. There's a lot of problems with the cancer cluster studies. I know that there's a pediatric cancer study. There was a bill passed, and it is just dragging on without really making any results. I don't think this is the information that a lot of corporations want the public to have. You know, I've listened to Mary Olson speak, and she is an expert in learning how radiation impacts the human body. And one of the things that I've learned from her is that women are more susceptible to cancer from radiation exposure. And a lot of that, from what I understood of what she was saying, has to do with the fact that our bodies, you know, we have more reproductive organs. You know, it takes up more space on our bodies. And so the radiation can reach more of our breast and, you know, the ovaries and the whole system, right? This makes women more susceptible to cancer. I believe, according to Mary Olson's studies, it might even be as high as 2 to 1 at certain points of the life of women getting more cancer than men from radioactive exposure. So it makes sense when you see this map that you're seeing higher breast cancer rates in radioactive areas. This is indeed reaching the populations. That's what you would expect to see. And the science backs it up. I just wish that there was more epidemiological studies that are looking at the causation, but those are very difficult studies, and our government doesn't seem very keen to be producing those.
Ignorance is bliss, or at least it keeps everybody down.
Right, and when we look at these kind of maps, then they say, well, you're fear-mongering, or you're, you know, don't make assumptions. But this is just kind of common sense. When you look at the maps and you see cancer clusters that they've identified in this study and they're in radioactive sites, I mean, at least if nothing else, it's reason for concern.
You also forwarded a map to me, and I will have that posted on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 669.
Melissa Bumstead of Parents Against the Santa Susana Field Lab. We will post that map of breast cancer incidents that she referenced and a link to the full report. They will be up on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 669. Kathy Iwane lived in Wakayama, Japan for more than 25 years until the Fukushima nuclear disaster in 2011. By 2012, she and her son moved to Southern California, where they found themselves inadvertently living in close proximity to the leaking, dangerous San Onofre nuclear generating station. Kathy fought for San Onofre's closure and now fights for its cleanup and the safe storage of radioactive waste. She's also continued working on a range of nuclear issues. Here, she reiterates some important talking points she's recently discovered about artificial intelligence and nukes that were part of her talk. Kathy Iwane, at the discussion that we just came out of here at UC Santa Barbara, you made some startling observations of what you had learned about an AI and nuclear connection. Tell us what it was that you were sharing with the audience.
Thank you, Libby, for having me again. Always a pleasure to speak with you. First of all, allow me to explain a little disclaimer here. I am in no way any expert on this topic. I'm just very, very concerned as a concerned citizen of the world we enter. Iran has been shooting drones over Israel, and we're at a very brink in terms of nuclear proliferation. I'm very, very concerned about this nuclear connection to AI. That is all. And with that, before my presentation, I happened to look into what is the normal average person who doesn't know what small modular reactors or this ridiculous concept that hasn't been proven of small modular reactors. What is it and what is this connection? So I Googled it just for the layman's sake of perhaps definition, and here's what it came up with. Very simple. Small modular reactors have been tutored to offer potential to generate huge amounts of energy in modular and decentralized ways. This presents a very attractive solution for powering AI data centers. So if that doesn't sort of get you hook, line, and sinker, the average person is being given information from a Google search that this is a very positive thing. So I became alarmed when I read that first search. And to explain my alarm, what do I mean? So I dug a little further and I found that in January, the International Energy Agency issued projections for global energy over the next 2 years. And for the first time in its projections, they included such things as mining cryptocurrency, data centers, and AI data centers. So just taking these three things together, suffice it to say that by 2026, the demand for these uses could double, making it roughly equal to the amount, total amount of electricity used by the entire country of Japan. That's kind of crazy. We have to understand that machine learning or AI requires a lot of energy. For example, a single Google search takes 0.3 watt hours of electricity. On the other hand, one ChatGPT request, that's AI, takes 2.9 watt hours of the same electricity. So right there, you can see why investors would be very excited to attach what is touted as green, non-carbon. It's touted as being a very green technology, nuclear. Attach one of these SMRs to your AI data center. Now, another thing that's really, really alarming is that in order to cool these AI data centers, it takes water, right? So I dug a little deeper and I found that in order to cool this sort of system, with each ChatGPT request, it's taking a half liter of water, each one, to cool down this system that is getting hot because it takes so much energy. So I'll put that into perspective. A normal data center needs about 32 megawatts of power flowing through the building. Okay, so that's like your Google, all of your searches. And yet, to compare this, an AI data center would need 80 megawatts of energy flowing through the building. And so it's something that we're going to have to look into. Researchers, we really need all of our nuclear experts. We need all of the researchers, energy, our energy professionals to look into, number one, where is this going? Number two, there are no regulations. Right now, there's no regulations. And you hear a lot of these investors saying, we need to do this. We've got money. We've got lobbyists. We can get around the regulations. That's a dangerous thing. And why is it dangerous? This technology is the same as the technology used on nuclear submarines. Let's talk about the nuclear submarines. Those are operated and manned by very, very, very technical, prize-winning, multi-PhD, government-secure clearance maintaining individuals. These people are actually respected in our military. They are the top of the top. What if we took this same technology, we put it in the commercial arena, and attached that technology to an AI data center? Give me a break. It's a slippery slope and it's dangerous. Small modular reactors have not even been proved to be working, a working reality. And finally, the US has 90,000 plus tons of spent nuclear fuel, nuclear waste, you know, stranded at over 76 sites in the United States. We're making 2,000 more metric tons each year. Why would we look into this technology?
So this would explain why Bill Gates is so hyped and so adamant and so insistent upon having small modular nuclear reactors. I always like to put in the other N word because they like taking it out so we don't pay attention to it. But small modular nuclear reactors is because this would be creating a means of powering his mega plans for whatever it is he's planning to do next.
Exactly, Libby. I mentioned certain billionaires, I think is how I defined it in my talk. And I think you're on the right track there. I had a lot of people come up to me afterward and they said, well, what do you think about just 100% abolition? Let's, you know, and we've spoken a lot about nuclear war. We've spoken a lot about the military industrial complex. And it's hard. It's Pandora's box has been opened with the Manhattan Project. But the one thing that I think is a one little ray of hope is that we've got amazing, amazing technology in the sustainable energy field. And if these investors in sustainable energy, renewable energy, could latch onto this and get ahead of the game in working on regulation. For example, they could be the investors in getting the regulation through for renewable centers powering these AI. I don't know if we can say, let's stop AI, because I agree with you. Can we go back? I just think that that's an impossibility. So rather than these multi-billion dollar individuals investing in getting their lobbyists in Congress, I wonder if we can get local governments and local investors that are proponents of decentralized renewable energy to get a huge movement going to invest in the regulations that are going to be necessary to power these AI centers. Safer option, right?
This reminds me of Isaac Asimov when he was writing about the laws of robotics. And the first one is that robots were not allowed to harm a human being. And I don't know whether a similar program has been proposed, let alone instituted, regarding AI, but it's entirely possible that one of these systems could look at what human beings are doing to the planet and go, wow, that's a pest. Let's get rid of them. Zot! And exactly. We're gone.
Exactly.
Everything that was written about in science fiction books that I read when I was in my high school years and into college seems to be sort of happening now.
I know.
And that may be part of what's behind, you know, my passion to do this work. So AI is another one of the threats that we have. Certainly, if it becomes involved with nuclear anything, we are abdicating the human right to control, as flawed as that may be, but at least there's thinking involved. You can change your direction. You can change what you're doing. We are abdicating the right for human beings to be the ones who make the decisions and allowing computer programs and algorithms and God only knows what could be programmed into them by some malcontents to decide the future of what's happening with nuclear.
Exactly.
So can we all get drunk and dance on the beach now? Whatever it takes to keep going. That was Kathy Iwane. Amanda M. Nichols is a postdoctoral research fellow in the Environmental Studies program at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Dr. Nichols' primary research falls at the intersections of environmental history and religious and gender studies and focuses on the roles and contributions of women in the North American anti-nuclear movement. She also sports a CV with too long a list of credentials to mention on air, or we're not going to fit the whole show in. Here, we talk about what it takes to put together a conference like this and how others can learn how to do it for their schools or communities.
I'm talking with Amanda Nichols, who's the woman responsible for all of us being here and participating in the Global Legacies event that's been taking place at UC Santa Barbara. Amanda, how did this come about? What's the background?
Thank you, Libby. The background is that Martin Klimka and I, who's my co-organizer, we met in 2022 in Munich at the Rachel Carson Center for another event that was focused on Petra Kelly. And while we were there, we got to talking about our common interests, our shared interests, and both of us have this interest in anti-nuclear activism, anti-nuclear history, especially like in the United States, but with a more transnational perspective. And so at that conference, we sort of started scheming about, well, what if we maybe did something like this? There needs to be more of a conversation about environmental justice, perspectives related to anti-nuclear activism. So we wanted to bring a group of people together to do sort of what we did in Munich, but around this topic and shared interest of ours. So about 2 months after the conference, we ended up having a conversation via Zoom, and it all came together from there. We started planning, and it's been about a year and a half process, but here we are today, and it has shaped up really nicely, so we're really pleased to be here.
How did you go about getting the speakers and determining who was going to be here?
Well, that's a great question. So Mary Olson is a personal friend of mine, so I knew from the outset that I wanted her to be here because I've seen her speak several times, and I've worked really closely with her during my own dissertation research, and then since, I'm currently working on another project with her. The others were people that Martin and I were both familiar with. They're scholars who are environmental historians. They're very well respected in their various fields and in their daily lives, what they do and what they study. So we knew we wanted a diverse group of people who could talk about environmental justice issues from a variety of perspectives. So when we set about planning a program, we invited the keynote speakers first, and we issued a call for papers for the other participants to come out, and we selected the ones that were what we thought the most fitting for the topic that we had decided on. So we've got a great group of people here together from all over the world, and we're really happy that they could all come and join us.
I noticed yesterday that all the speakers who I experienced were women. Was that intentional?
It certainly was. My own dissertation research focused on the role of women in the anti-nuclear movement in North America. And so when I set about planning this conference, that was one key thing that I wanted to make sure, because women's voices have not been part of the conversation about nuclear in a very robust way throughout its history. So we really wanted to make sure to make that presence known and to give them a platform to be able to come and, you know, offer a different perspective than what the nuclear industry and the men in the nuclear industry in particular have been telling us for generations now.
We still have 2 days left of this marvelous conference, and there's an incredible array of people here. What has been the response that you've received so far to what's been presented?
We've gotten spectacular feedback on all of the presentations that have been given, the keynote presentations and the roundtable panel that happened yesterday. I think people are really thrilled. The film screening last night as well, I think people were really happy to see Heidi Huttner come out and screen the documentary Radioactive. And people are really happy to be here. It's very nice for everyone to have the opportunity to come into this space and to talk with other people who are interested in the same topics that they are. And then our workshop participants, too, the way we've laid this out, it's more of a community-based and like small kind of intimate conference so that they really have the opportunity to talk with one another and get to know one another. We all share a common interest. So I think it's been a really generative and productive space for learning and engagement, but also for building community. So I'm really happy with that.
How important do you think it is for other universities to step forward and put together programs like this?
Oh, I think it's absolutely super important. This is what my whole career is based on at this point, and I would love to see more conferences, small conferences like this, bring this to the fore in university systems. It's such an important topic as we move into the future, as we move into a climate insecure future. It's really important to focus on how nuclear plays a role in that conversation. And so I would love to see a lot more programming like this across universities in the U.S. and also abroad.
How would they get started?
I think it starts with a person who has a genuine interest in this topic and a passion for disseminating information about it to the public in particular. I think they need support. This, you know, it takes a lot of support to put on an event like this. And so there has to be institutional support, but also community support. So it really is, it takes a network of people and a community to do something like this, but it really starts with one or two individuals who have an idea and start scheming and go, oh, let's figure out how we can make this happen. So I wish them the best of luck.
And if there should be an individual or two out there who is listening to this and going, wow, what a great idea, how might they be able to contact you just to get a few words of advice and guidance?
I'm a postdoctoral research fellow at the University of California, Santa Barbara. So my website has my email address on it. They should feel free to reach out, and I'd be happy to talk through any of the logistics and planning with them that we did here and to maybe offer some guidance about how they might be able to do this for themselves.
And what is your website?
It's just the University of California, Santa Barbara Environmental Studies page.
Conference organizer, Dr. Amanda M. Nichols of UC Santa Barbara. We'll have a link up for you to contact her if you'd like advice and information about putting together your own conference on nuclear issues of local concern. Demonstrating much of what Amanda spoke about regarding community building was Jane Swanson of San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace. Jane was not an official speaker at the conference, but came to provide support and continue to educate herself.
I'm really pleased that I was able to be here and meet some wonderful presenters on the panel and the other people. I met a lovely woman from Scotland who was here. She came to California. She went to a conference in San Francisco like 3 days ago, and she was here tonight. She's going back to Scotland on Sunday, and she was very interested. So I'm very pleased at the variety of people who are here today.
How do events like this help with the work that you and the other mothers are doing to shut down Diablo Canyon permanently?
It's always a tremendous help when we can interact with people fighting similar issues in other locations, because we have a lot in common. And the fact that a woman from Scotland was so interested in what's going on at Diablo Canyon and at Santa Susana, she was fascinated, and she teaches at a university, I don't know which one. She's going to encourage her students to do research on Mothers for Peace, among other groups. Yeah, and we're going to do a little dinner gathering here of other people who are here. So networking is essential to us, to the mothers, and to all environmental groups, because the opposition has a whole lot of money, the federal government, California State Legislature, Pacific Gas and Electric Company. They have endless money, and it comes from us, the ratepayers and the taxpayers. And Mothers for Peace does not have those resources, but we are in the midst of a fundraising campaign. We need to raise, over like 3 years, a total of $400,000 in order to follow through on our legal cases. Our time is now. We either stop Diablo in the next few months, or it goes for another 40 years, so we're pulling out all the stops.
The next 40 years, or until oops.
Yes, yes, you're right, until oops. We hope there's no oops, but, you know, it's extremely dangerous with its embrittled reactor vessel. It's got to end.
Jane Swanson, a longtime member of San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace. Also from San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace is Linda Seeley. She has served as vice president and spokesperson for the group since 2009. She has also been a member of the Diablo Canyon Decommissioning Engagement Panel since its inception in 2018. Here, she shares not only about what she does, but why she does it.
I'm talking with Linda Seeley of San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace. She has been here for the Global Legacies Conference and was a speaker on a panel yesterday. Linda, at the very end of your talk, you spoke about why you and why we do this work.
I was talking about what motivates us to hang in with this work. This work is daunting. It's very disappointing most of the time, because we lose most of the time. But there's this force inside of us. I'm talking about my group right now, the San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace. It's this knowledge and understanding that we're part of a bigger picture, and that our actions right now affect all of the generations that are going to come. And what do we want? We want life to go on. And what we see as a possibility is just the opposite of that. And so if we can commit ourselves into action and actually do whatever it is that our own particular talents allow us to do, and use our own brains and our own hearts and our own love for the world, that's how we could possibly win this. And we'll be able to say to our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren, we did this for you. I just happen to be a great-grandmother now. And it makes it all so much more vivid for me when I see that little beautiful baby, three generations from me, who's already come into this world. It's profound. So I'm not going to quit till I'll die with my boots on, as they say.
Thank you for that.
Yeah.
What haunts me
is the thought that, I mean, I know I will not see the culmination of my work. That's just not possible. We're all Moses going towards the promised land, and it's way off somewhere else. But what haunts me is the thought that perhaps my contribution to this is in some way making a difference. And if I don't make that contribution, that difference won't be there. And that might be the very thing that stops us from winning. And I can't let myself take on that level of responsibility. It might be terrifically codependent of me, but I really don't care. I know I'm on the side of the angels. I'm on the side of the good guys. I am fighting for life because I love it so dearly. And while I don't have any children that I know of, which means there are no grandchildren or great-grandchildren, you have them, and others do. And I'm fighting for them.
Yeah. Well, that's what we're all about, Libby. You know, I'm here at this conference. I see these young people who are academically looking at the anti-nuclear movement. I'm thinking to myself, through each and every one of these papers that I'm listening to, how is the passion that you and I feel about this issue, how is that reignited into the generation coming up? The powers that be have done such a great snow job on the America, on the world public, about how great nuclear power is, and not to worry about nuclear weapons. And so we are in this kind of fog of denial right now with the younger people, and I am just craving an uprising and trying to remember what it was that brought me into this work. You know, why do I still feel so passionate about it? What incidents happened in my life that allowed me to be able to commit my life to this? And I think it's has to do with other people like you and other people I've met in this movement who are literally the best people I've ever met. Literally. The smartest, the strongest, the hardest working, the most compassionate, the most questioning. It's a gift to be among these people. If only other people could understand and get in here with us. I feel like we have a lot to give to the next generation coming. And that's all I want to do, is help them get motivated and carry on. Light the fire. Keep it lit.
Linda Seeley of San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace. On the website, I've posted a picture of Linda proudly showing a picture of her three-week-old great-grandson, who is the latest piece of what keeps this woman motivated to keep fighting back against Diablo Canyon and other nuclear nightmares. There were many other speakers at this conference who had fascinating, powerful insights about what we're up against from a variety of directions, and what we need to be doing to build not only an anti-nuclear movement, but an anti-injustice movement that melds together groups and concerns that are much more related than we might currently be aware of. I was unable to obtain audio of these presentations, and personal concerns forced me to leave the conference sooner than I would have liked, so I did not secure all the interviews I wanted. But I will be following up with many of the participants and hope to interview them on their thoughts and concerns for future episodes of Nuclear Hot Seat.
Activists, shout out.
Starting out with a reminder of our lead story on the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, which needs your support. There are only 23 days that Congress will be sitting between now and the expiration of RECA. We need you, all of you, whether you've done it before or not, do it again. Contact your representative in the U.S. House of Representatives and urge them to support the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act so that those who have been harmed by the U.S. nuclear activities on our own land will be compensated, at least in part, for their illnesses, pain, and suffering that were inflicted by our wrong-headed nuclear policies. Fukushima Fallout Awareness Network wants to bring your attention to their citizens' petition, which calls on FDA to drastically lower the current allowable levels of cesium-134 and 137 in food. We allow more radiation in food than Japan does, which means they can offload food to contaminated for their people on us, and they are doing so, especially to U.S. military who are stationed in Japan. We'll link to the FDA and that petition on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 669. In honor of Earth Day, which is April 22nd, the makers of San Onofre Syndrome, Nuclear Power's Legacy, are providing their film for free online through streaming. This very generous offer ends as of April 22nd, so we will provide the link for you to be able to sign up and access that film. Well worth your time. It's already a multiple award winner. And speaking of films, the International Uranium Film Festival keeps chugging ahead on its tour of North America, showing up in Salem, Oregon, this Friday, April 19, and Saturday, April 20. Those screenings were organized by Nuclear Abolition Now, a year-old Salem group that's a subsidiary of Oregon Peace Works. And of course, we will have a link up and available to you at nuclearhotseat.com, episode 669. And one more film. As of tomorrow, Wednesday, April 17, PBS will be airing Diablo Canyon, California's last nuclear power plant. It will be shown as of 7:30 p.m. Pacific time and should be up for a while after that. It's important to take a look because some of the verbiage coming out in the press releases from PBS look like they've taken a pretty big slug of the pro-nuclear Kool-Aid, with verbiage about the setback for anti-nuclear activists is welcome news for climate activists, hello, and a major detour in the Northern Chumash journey to reclaim their ancestral lands. Little bit of cultural insensitivity going on there. So watch PBS and get ready to respond. Let them know what you think. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, April 16, 2024. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, it's the easiest way for you to never miss out on another episode. Just fill out the yellow opt-in box. You really can't miss it. Put in your first name and email address, and every week you will get one email with the link to the show and a short description of its contents. And you get it as soon as we post, so you can jump to the head of the anti-nuclear line. Now here's another way you can help us out. You're in your local community, you see what's going on, and if something's going on, let us know. If you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send that information in an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your help and will appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2024, Libby Halevi and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, the website, and the name of any guest whose comments you use, as well as me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you that the last thing anyone who opposes nuclear wants to be able to say is, "I told you so." Let's not let it get to that. There you've got it. You have just received your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because face it, we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.